imagine. I am, as usual, seated atop a completely bald hill, except for a small apple tree that every year bears one or two beautifully perfect apples. My piano's there. The wind is blowing. It's what I do each night as the enormous moon rises. The sun sails swiftly to the sea. Whisper, pray, and sing to me, remember me. Sorry for that. I thought I was going to stop at any moment, but then it kept going. I kept remembering it. Usually I forget it after 30 seconds. Pull the parachute, grab my 300 yards of purple string, and I'm down to the ground. Like an old World War II flying ace. What time is it? Oh, it's well after this. The show has already begun. Let's begin the show, because it's already begun.
Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Show and Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take them out soon. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but don't take my shoes.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
Empire State Building. Tune in, Tokyo. Tune in. Why in the world did anyone ever say tune in, Tokyo? I know it's a children's game, but what's the origin of that? Tune in, Tokyo. The broadcasters make the request that cities or other listeners, potential listeners, tune in. Now tune in now, and tune in next week. I can see that. Tune in next week for another exciting episode of The Radio Ghost. But I wouldn't say, tune in, Wichita, Kansas. Because they wouldn't be listening. They're not going to start listening. So letter here, letter to the editor and the local paper. Enjoy reading these letters to the editor. This one's called, has a heading, Stolen Planter. It's from Laurie Haney. Did the person who took the ceramic planter outside my Pennycook beauty salon, the long and short of it, think it was put there to be taken? I bought the planter 2 years ago to display in front of my salon. It had pretty pink and purple flowers and a tall green plant in the middle that reminded you of a small palm tree. The pink and purple flowers had gone by. However, the little green palm tree still looked wonderful, even in November. In fact, I had a client tell me how good it still looked, that I should just leave it all winter and hang Christmas balls from it. Maybe that was the same idea the person who took it had. Or maybe they just figured it was there and they wanted it, so they took it. Or maybe whoever took it was just downright mean, taking something that didn't belong to them. I hope the person who took my planter feels bad. As my grandmother used to say, I guess you must have needed it more than I did. I hope you're enjoying it as much as my clients and I did. Please take good care of my little palm tree the way I did, because it really did mean a lot to me. Laurie Haney. Sounds like Laurie comes from a long line of people from whom things were stolen. The grandmother's always remarking, well, I guess they must have needed it more than I. You'll soon learn that, young Laurie. People will take and take, it doesn't matter what it is. Could be an ugly little planter with all the dead flowers and a green palm tree in it. Outside your beauty salon, whatever it is you turn out to be and do and whatever you decide to hang, it will be taken. But always remember, whoever takes it in a passive-aggressive way needed it more than you did. It's my watchword, it's what I live by, it's my own slogan. We don't quite have bumper stickers because it's 1953, but if we did, that's what I'd have on mine. Well, you must have needed it more than I. I'm glad you have it. It's a good thing you took all my money and my jewelry. I'm sure you'll make good use of them. You look better in that ring than I ever did. I always wasted my money anyway. I'm sure you'll do a better job than I could have. I spend it on God knows what. Look at all these things, these trinkets all about. But you know, when things like that happen, we get wild inside. We want to lash out. Sometimes the only way to lash out is in the form of the community scribble board. The community scribble board of the newspaper. And then it's not an anonymous letter, but it's written as though it is being received by whatever criminal. Dear you, and you know who you are, you did this to me, and I want you to know all these different things that's done. Look what you've done. Now look what you've done. Don't you just feel rotten?
Kraft presents The Great Gildersleeve. Each week at this time, Kraft presents from Hollywood, California, Harold Perry as the Great Gildersleeve, written by Leonard L. Levinson. We'll hear from the Great Gildersleeve in just a moment.
Yes, Mr. Mellon.
But first, here's something I'd certainly be puzzling about if I were a housewife these days, and that's the problem of how to serve my family all the wholesome, nutritious foods they need and still keep within my budget.
What's the problem?
And now let's visit our friend, the Great Gildersleeve.
That's me. The Great Gildersleeve. I can't tell you how long I've lived my life not knowing who the Great Gildersleeve, or Sleeve, was. The Great Gildersleeve, I've often thought that I should somehow channel myself in that direction, become somewhat like the Great Gildersleeve as I had the last name already in place. All I need is a great and a gilder. Drop the S off the end and I'm as close as you can get. It always felt like that. I always wondered, well, I wonder if I'm very similar to the Great Gildersleeve. I'm very like him. But then I guess I imagined he was some sort of a detective, mystery man, solving crimes, household crimes, little things around town, an amateur sleuth. Pompous, ridiculous, and yet he always got his man. I don't know if that's right, it could be. That's what feels right to me. I don't know if you caught it, that man who's mentioned it, the advertising man who came on, said something about, there was a very hypothetical presentation. He was saying, I don't know about you, but if I was a housewife, I know I'd be quite worried about making things all come together. But it's not. A strange advertising tactic. Ever hypothetical. Well, I know if I was a man on the moon, I'd need to have this kind of brush. Keep the hair from floating away. You'd need hair slick. Anyway, there should be more hypothetical advertisements. They should all begin, if I needed this product, as though. So this evening we're going to talk about, and let me say, I'm very pleased to see you all here, all the old friends, Mr. Christopher Budd, Christina, Paul, Ted, and I think there's others in the background. If you have any questions, ask in the chat room. I'll try to answer them, or you can call. I didn't turn on the Skype. I think it's just too much for my old system to bear. I think that's why I couldn't record the, I don't know which one it was, 40. So I have a new thing that I'm going to try, and we may not try it, but I'll be trying to try it. I have a phone here. And a Google Voice number, 603-722. I don't know what it is. 0540? That might be it. Now, I'm not expecting any calls, but if you want to call, let's do it that way. 603-722-0540. And then I'll do what they did in the old days, which is I'll put the phone up near the microphone so that can be heard. Now, I don't know how well that would work, but I like poor solutions sometimes. Prefer them to the slicker solutions. So I was out walking just a few days ago. Had this little experience. One of those experiences that the tiny mysteries of life that niggle away at the corners and you never, ever can solve them, and they remain perfectly obscure for the rest of your life, and they're household mysteries. So I'm out walking, and I'm a few miles from where I live here, in a place that I go by once a week, I would say, and I'm eating a banana. I don't think I mentioned that, but I often bring fruit out with me when I walk. I bring an apple or banana, and I'll eat it as I'm going. Fruit I associate with walking. I don't know where fruit belongs in the food bin. I know we're supposed to eat it, but I don't know when to eat it, so I eat it while walking. It doesn't go with, you don't have a sandwich and an apple, I can't. It doesn't seem to fit in with any of the meals. You just have to shove it in there somewhere. Where are you going to put it? I'll eat my apple in the car as I'm driving to work. As I'm walking from the kitchen table to the bedroom, I will eat a banana. You just have to get it in. It's like exercise of some kind. It's fruit. Fruiticize. So I'm eating a banana, and I'm looking for a place to throw the banana peel out. And of course, there is that small wonder of if I'm littering or not. I know it's biodegradable, yet there is a small sticker on it. I perpetually am wondering if that means that's littering, and I often will take the sticker off and just stick it to my pant leg, and then it falls off later when I don't know about it, but at least I tried. And sometimes I don't bother with that. If I'm in a very remote area, I think mostly this is good. It's 98% biodegradable, 2% sticker, and perhaps that's all right. So I'm walking and I'm getting into this area where there's a woman, I don't know her name, but she lives alongside the road and there's not really much else going on. She has a small garden that she's an avid gardener. She gardens in the winter. I'll see her out there with some small fork stabbing the ground. I've actually asked gardeners whether it's possible to garden in the winter, and I've gotten mixed responses. Some say you can do certain things, preparations to the ground. Others confirm what I have long thought, that the woman is mad. Now, there are people in our world who we... It's not that we don't get along with them, but we don't mix well with them. And sometimes this ends up in a kind of antipathy. You have a strange enemy in the world, a local person. You don't even know why they're your enemy. That's one thing, and I have that with some person, but not this woman. With this woman, we both have determined that the other one is absolutely insane. So I think she's mad and she thinks I am. And it's fine because we don't have too much to do, but we do intersect in one area. And it's in the area of the bunny rabbits. Now, near her home, the road banks up on both sides. And a year or two ago, I spotted two little, very unrealistic-looking rabbits. We're getting close to the Terence McKenna. Let me see if I can pause this. I'll pause it if we get to the next one. So these rabbits, they look like stuffed animals. They don't look like real creatures from the woods. And as it turns out, they were once domesticated rabbits that were set free. So one of them is white with brown spots, and the other one is half black, half white, and very neatly so, like an Oreo cookie-looking creature. So they're sitting up on the hill, like these two stuffed animals that rolled out of a car. And I find out later that these were just rabbits set free. Let me stop this here. And we'll pick it up in a moment. So, and as it turns out, this woman is somewhat the caretaker of these rabbits. She didn't let them go. She knows who released them, and she will put out food. And apparently you can do this with rabbits. They get free. Sometimes people release them to the wild, and they survive. Oddest-looking little clown animals that they are. Not matching anything. Very vulnerable. Like, just too much too decorative to be permitted in a woodland scene. They'd look fine in a store window, but silly by the side of the road. So she puts out carrots and whatever rabbits eat. And when I see her, as a matter of course, I will ask after her bunny rabbits. It's our way of being mutually insane together. I'm hopefully avoiding that sensation, that creeping feeling that this other person's mad. So I am walking up the road with my banana peel now, still looking for a place to discard the peel. And she's in her garden, and I say, "How are the bananas doing?" And immediately I realize that I've misspoken, and I look at her, and I feel, I'm thinking, oh, she knows that I'm a crazy person. And she, without any kind of indication that she's heard me say bananas, she says, "Oh, they're fine. They're fine. I just saw one right over there." She points off in a certain direction and turns back to her gardening. And I don't know why it is, but then as she turns away, I throw my banana peel in the sort of direction where she's indicated the bunny was. And I don't know if it's because I thought the rabbit might want it, or I felt compelled. It was just an automatic movement. She turned to look at her garden. I threw it away. So then I think to myself, I wonder, did she not hear me say bananas? Or is it that she thinks I'm a madman and I call things whatever I like to call them, and that's how it is for me? So I'm curious, and I step a little bit closer to her. Now I'm free of my banana peel. I can move about the world freely. And I say, "Well, you know, I haven't seen those bananas in 3 or 4 months, I suppose." And she says very simply, without even looking at me, "Oh, they're around. They're around here and there." And I was very clear the second time. I was absolutely sure that I said bananas. Because sometimes you say something and you're pretty sure you said it, but you don't know. This time I did it on purpose. And I went on my way. Went off on my way, wondering, is this a part of the madness she perceives in me? Or is this evidence of her own madness that when I say bananas, she hears bunnies? And I want to ask her so badly as I'm walking away, but I realize it's one of those done and complete deals that you can't go back. I can't find out what the truth is. I have to let it go. And so I do. Bunnies or bananas. And let me see if I can trigger this back on. Now, we're going to listen to a little bit from Terence McKenna. Let me just check here. Yes, that's it, Chris. 603-722-7222. 80540. I don't even know if that's it, but it's what I said. 603-722-BANANAS. Christina the Nitwit. Well, most of the most wonderful people I know are half-nitwit. That means that they're just batty in one place, and it can be a very tiny place, but it could be a tiny place that other people just can't tolerate. For example, saying bananas when you mean bunnies. That's something that happens. I don't often misspeak. Well, maybe I do. I don't know. It feels to me that I don't. It feels like a very unique event when I say bananas instead of bunnies. But who knows? Maybe whenever I'm around her, I'm always calling the bunnies some other fruit. Whatever. How are the apples doing today? Because we're not often, we don't continually track ourselves. So anyway, I'm going to play a bit, since we're getting to December of 2012, and there's a collective notion of an end of times. Most of it silly. I thought it'd be nice to hear a reasonable presentation on the end of the universe, or the beginning of the next universe, as it comes to seem, at least to the, I would say, that he's a genius, Terence McKenna. He is either a genius of a certain truth that is yet to become, or he is a genius of a truth that will never become. Regardless, his thinking, his articulation, his whole body, his sensibility is wonderfully a genius feeling to me. And he is sadly deceased. He died in 2000, I think. But here is a bit of his scientific prophecy about the end of time.
Well, novelty theory is something I've been working on since the early 70s, inspired by psychedelic plant experiences in the Amazon, to attempt to look at time and really deconstruct it and attempt to understand what it is. And this has been a wild intellectual ride, leading to some pretty easily stated conclusions. One is that novelty, which is my term for complexity or advanced organization, novelty increases as we approach the present moment. The universe you and I are living in is a far more novel and complicated place than the early universe was. Well, some people would say, well, that's just a consequence of the unfolding of developmental processes. But this asks the question, what are developmental processes? Why should the universe have a preference for order over disorder, especially when we have something called the second law of thermodynamics, which tells us exactly the opposite? Physicists believe the universe is running down ultimately into a state of disorder. But what I see is everywhere the emergence of more and more complex forms, languages, organisms, technologies, always building on the previously achieved levels of complexity. So that was one of my insights. Coming out of that insight was the further understanding that this process of complexification through time is not proceeding at a steady rate. It actually follows a kind of asymptotic curve. In other words, it's happening faster and faster. And this was a revelation to me because it allowed me philosophically to contextualize the human world and to understand that human technologies, languages, migrations, art movements, ideologies are not something different from nature. They're the same download of process that we see in the movement of continents, the evolution of new species of animals, except that these human novel emergent situations are happening much more quickly. So I see the cosmos, if you will, as a kind of novelty-producing engine, a kind of machine which produces complexity in all realms, physical, chemical, social, whatever, and then uses that achieved level of complexity as the platform for further complexity. Well, this explains our present circumstance. It explains the rush toward all forms of new technology and social organization in the new millennium. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that if the universe is complexifying faster and faster, an epoch, a time will come when this rate of complexification is occurring so rapidly that it will become itself the overwhelming phenomena in the world of three-dimensional space and time. And I call this the omega point, or the transcendental object at the end of history. And I believe it is not that far off, that with the emergence of a global internet, a human population of several billions, an electronic noosphere, that we are now within the shadow of this transcendental object at the end of time. Our religions sense it. That's what gives them their apocalyptic intuitions. And I think the ordinary man and woman in the street sense a kind of built-in acceleration to time itself. Well, rather than dismissing that or treating it as a psychological perception or something unique to our society, I took it as a basic perception about physics, and have built elaborate, mathematically defined theories around this idea, and then have found, to my astonishment, incredible congruences with other work. I'm thinking of the Mayan calendar and its curious countdown-like quality toward an extremely unique event that the Maya felt would occur in the same time frame that my own equations predicted, even though at the time I was unaware of the Maya. So what we have here is a new model of time based on a very real intuition that I think most people share, which is that time is speeding up, that human beings are part of that process, and that the culmination of that process is now within the ven of historical time. In other words, I believe it will happen in 2012, in December, coincident with the same events that the Maya placed at the end of their calendar. Even if I'm wrong, even if it's 100 years or 500 years later, these are still spans of time that, when compared to the life of the planet, are fractions of a percentage. So whether you believe, as I do, that we can know the precise moment of this transformation of the world of time, or whether you believe it is simply coming soon and fast, really doesn't make that much difference. We are all gathered here at the end game of developmental processes on this planet. We are about to become unrecognizable to ourselves as a species. Our technologies, our religions, our science has pushed us toward this for thousands of years without us awakening to what the denouement would be. Now we stand close enough to it that I think all but the most lumpen among us must feel the tug of the transcendental and the transformative.
Thank you.
birds and the sea, they come looking for me, but they all fly straight into the sound. So that's Terence McKenna. I don't know if he describes himself by any particular term. I've seen ethnobotanist. He's very easily derided by the very hard science world from his reliance or for his reliance or for his psychedelic-based inquisitions. A lot of what a lot of his thoughts and theories have developed out of a psychedelic experience with psilocybin mushrooms and other hallucinogenics. He's traveled down to the Amazon. He reports on... Now, I should say, I am not a hallucinogenic mushroom imbiber. No, I've never had any interest in it. But I will say this. Terence McKenna makes a very interesting case for hallucinogenic chemicals, plant-based chemicals, not man-based chemicals, but plants in the jungle, mushrooms and other things. He makes a very provocative case for their being the mind-broadening, self-conscious makers of humanity. Meaning back in the pre-conscious, pre-self-reflective worlds, the tribal worlds of shaman and leaves, that certain mushrooms with psychedelic properties, which became a part of the tribal ritualistic culture, were expansive in certain ways that allowed the people themselves to begin to see themselves in ways that would be considered more self-aware than prior. And I can see that. And so it's his thought that awareness itself was deepened, that realization of self was first seen through people in the woods tripping out on mushrooms. I don't have a critical thought on that. I simply think it's interesting. Look him up he's got a lot of videos on YouTube. Terence McKenna. He's increasingly compelling. So the more you listen to him, the more you are drawn to him. And there are times when I've watched a number of things. I've read half of one of his books called The Fruit of the Gods, which is about his travels down to the Amazon to imbibe this mysterious ayahuasca substance, hallucinogenic mixture. And there are times that when I'm, usually when I'm listening to him talk, that he's so articulate and so bright. However, whatever the truth of his message, that I find myself weeping from the sense of joy and pleasure in witnessing a mind working so well. I mean, he may be out of his mind. But if you want to be impressed by a thinker, I would say spend some time with Terence McKenna. Just looking at the scribble board, the community scribble board. You've never tried anything, Christina. You must live in a paper box down at the metal factory. I have to send you some 2% wine, get you started. Or you can skip the wine, read McKenna's Food of the Gods. Did I call it Fruit of the Gods? I almost called it Bananas of the Gods. Should have called it Bunnies of the Gods. And you can skip all those other things and just get a ticket down to the Amazon. Go wandering around until you meet a hunched over a fellow named Tika and ask him for the oil black ayahuasca drink. Don't eat anything for 24 hours prior to that. And don't be upset when after you drink it, you begin to retch. As you will, despite having nothing in your gut, you will vomit. Which is proof of the excellence of the ayahuasca. Thank you, Paul. I'm sure I'm saying it. I hope I'm saying it wrong. I don't want to say it as though I'm an old hand. There's certain words it's good to say wrong, as though you really don't know what they are. You don't want to be too wise, too well-spoken on them. Ayahuasca. Ayahuasca? Ayahuasca. Oh, you don't know. Well, I don't either. That's my best guess. My best guest. Coming up soon, my best guest. So what else is there in the world? Let me see whatever I've got here. I saw something the other day that triggered a memory from childhood. When I was a boy, on the street that I grew up on, Washington Street, there was this short period of time when, and it may have been a few months or a few years, it's hard to cast back, but there was a time when this phenomenon occurred and then it was gone. It's sort of like a swarm of locusts. Every 17 years or whatever it is, this was something specific to my neighborhood. It didn't go outside of it, but just in my street. One day, I was walking along, and on this fence, just stuck to the fence, was a great saw, like a handsaw, like one of those saws that people use as musical instruments and bend them around from your wood shop. It was a saw, and it was painted with a woodland scene. Not a very good one. A river with some mountains. Looked like something somebody who'd never painted before decided to try painting. And it said, "The Frisbees" on it, which was the name of the people who lived in the house there. So Mr. Frisbee had somehow decided, well, I'm going to paint my name on a sign with the woodland scene also upon it, and then hang that on our fence out front. Now, I was very taken with this. I didn't have any art judgment, I didn't think. In fact, I thought it was quite a good woodland scene. I thought the lettering was very fine. And as I would walk by, I thought, he's put out this saw as an expression of his identity, meaning he likes to cut things up. He's a saw user, and he wants everyone to know that's his hobby, is cutting things. Because I myself was somewhat of a similar hobbyist. I enjoyed getting sticks and even 2x4s and seeing if I could cut them up, get some pieces going, get a little pile of wood below me. That smell of wood, the sawdust. I was very proud of sawdust and piles of wood that I could make. So I thought, oh, Mr. Frisbee and I are very similar in this. We're both saw enjoyers. And then a second worry later, the next day perhaps, that he had taken his saw, his only one, his favorite one, and rendered it into this strange family sign. And so as I would walk by, I would peer in to his garage to see if I could see on his work table another saw, so that I could feel comforted that, yes, his hobby continued, he was still sawing. So there's that. Let me take a sip of tea. I don't know how long it passed, a week, probably a week. A week passes, and on the house directly across from the Frisbees, the Anderson's house, right up next to the door, above their mailbox, and they were the only family who kept the mailbox on the house. It was a strange thing. Most of the people on Washington Street had their mailboxes on posts right at the street, but the Andersons had one of those old letterboxes attached to the side of the house, so the postman had to actually get out and walk up and put the mail in. I don't know. I suppose you can do whatever you like with mail. Force them to do whatever you wish. Things are getting very quiet here. So, above the mailbox at the Anderson's house, there appeared this board, this routed board, stained kind of reddish, with the letters the Andersons routed out and by a router burned into the wood, and as though he'd done it with his finger, dug into the wood. I didn't know about routing back then. I thought he'd done some amazing bit of carpentry, a magical adult woodwork. And so now there was two. There was the Frisbees with the saw. There was the Andersons with the routed sign. And then, this manifestation was all via the men, because it continued. It set a course all through the street like a virus that only affected the gentlemen of the street. So the next house was about two or three houses down from the Andersons, from the Frisbees. And it was the Nugents. And what Mr. Nugent did was he took his old mailbox away, and he must have begun it early. Perhaps the same time that Mr. Anderson began his sign, but it took longer because it was more complicated. And he made a new mailbox for his family, and it was a birdhouse. But he'd painted fish on it, and then he'd written his first name, Paul, on it. So this is an adult 50-year-old man, heavy-set, who liked to mow his lawn, Paul Nugent, who decided to personalize his home as these other two had by making a birdhouse, calling it a mailbox, painting fish on it as though it were an aquarium, and then writing his first name on it. I always thought there was more of a story there that I didn't know. Even back then, I thought, you don't put your first name on things like that, Mr. Nugent. Now, there are probably three other manifestations of this signage, this identity signage, that went up the street different ways. Some people just got nameplate. But it was evident. You know, you walk up and down the street, and I had to get to school, you can see the changes as you come and go. They're just obvious. Now, the strangest one of all was Mr. Devon. Mr. Devon lived alone. He was one of those men who the children didn't trust at all, because sometimes he was very friendly and sometimes he was obliteratingly strange. Just hair a mess, peculiar look on his face, twisted eyes. And then other times he would clap his hands and say, "How are you doing, Sonny?" As though he was making amends for all the craziness prior. So what Mr. Devon began to do was he took these wooden pieces from his backyard, I don't know where he got them, and he started making some strange shape in his front yard. And then he began putting other things in it, cans of paint. And at first I just thought this was a pile of trash that he was preparing to take to the dump. But then it began to grow and move and take on a certain shape, and he would remove certain paint cans, and it was some kind of abstract work of pile art. And I must say, it wasn't unappealing. It had a certain kind of attraction, so that people, as they passed it, would stop, and maybe they wanted to be repulsed by it. It was interesting and captivating, and it wasn't as wrong as it might sound for being this strange, abstract pile of things from his garage. Now, what was odd about this, and I think this is what put all the other things, made it all come to an end, is people began adding to it, this Mr. Devon's pile. They would throw refuse in among a ball up a newspaper and throw it in there, or fruit like bananas and apples, and it started to seem almost like a place of invited danger. So it was a work of interesting neighborhood junk art, and then it became sort of a graffiti wall upon which strangers, I don't know who, were pushing other things in. They were beginning to attack. And then one day he set it on fire. I came home from work and set it on fire. And the following day, the identity business began to fade. First was Mr. Frisbee's saw. Then across the street, the Anderson's routed sign. The last to go was the Paul birdhouse. It stayed the longest, probably because he was most like Mr. Devon. But these things occur, these moments of peculiar community behavior. And I don't even know if it may be that Mr. Anderson was only semi-conscious of what Mr. Frisbee did across the street. It may be that Mr. Nugent hardly even registered that these other things had taken place, Mr. Devon as well. They were just following this peculiar wave, indulging in a way. Oh, Mr. Dave Brubeck died today. He's very old. He was over 80. After you get over the 80th year, being specific isn't very important. 86, 93, it's all the same. Between 80 and 120. Maybe it's interesting in one light, but basically, you're just very, very, very old. And you're lucky to still be alive, and then not. So here's a little Dave Brubeck. He's a piano player. He's known for his odd time signatures and his very catchy, but still yet within the art form, music. Dave Brubeck, Koto Song. Just let that go in the background. At the moment, Dave has been... He's resting in this peace, and he's resting in peace. This is music that definitely seems to accompany something. It's of itself, you know, you can sit and just listen, but images come to mind. It's mobile. It seems the music of the city, of that underground life. Crossing the streets, wandering. It's wandering around music. You're sort of looking for trouble. Looking for love. Challenging yourself somehow by what's about to happen. Trying to find something that will open you up. The music's there to make you strong. Strong enough to cross that street into the less lit part of town. Where there are things going on you've only heard about. But you wonder. Where's Dave? Narrative. We're in dream for a while. Dream. Uncertainty. And then back to the streets. And the evening's done. Did we find what we were looking for? Did we get where we were going? What did you find? Can you even remember? There's always tomorrow. They clapped and they clapped and then they all went silent. Room went silent. They stopped. I think that would be a new good way for audiences to do their audiencing. They all clap, 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 but then one person takes the lead. He's going to be the conductor. He stands up, Maybe it's a woman, maybe it's a child. They stand up, everyone eyes them, watches, and then, as a sign of respect, watching the conductor, the applause builds and builds as the conductor raises his arms, raises them higher and higher, the applause higher and higher, louder and louder, more and more raucous. Then suddenly he drops his hands and silence. To be both rapturous and controlled. I don't know if that would be a good thing. Just thought of it. The abbreviated recording that I had of Dave Brubeck's Coat of Song from 1966, a live performance somewhere. Well, what do we think? Where have we gotten ourselves to? Shall we call it a night? Try not to make these things too long. Keep them in the range of an hour. Well, let's thank our hosts here, Clutch and Wiggle Entertainment Network. We're here every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can find the show on iTunes. Search for Atoms, Motion in the Void. I put everything into that. So AMV episodes and the Radio Ghost episodes all get tumbled into that. And also on the website, radioghost.com and atomsmotion.com. Well, if you have anything you want me to play, audio, songs, Paul was recommending Robert Anton Wilson, if I'm remembering right. Ted was saying that Take Five, his must-own album. Maybe we'll play some Take Five next week. Maybe we'll play some Robert Anton Wilson, if that's the right person. But if you have anything of your own you want to send in, I'm fine with that. I got radiographs last week from Mrs. Zimmerman, 1942. I don't mind old things. You have something old in the house you want to send to me, feel free to do so. You can send me an email, sherwinsleeves@yahoo.com. We'll get you an address. You can send your old piece of wood, your old trinket, your old medical records, whatever you like. And we will integrate it into the show in some way. The Sounds of the City, that would be good. Sounds of the City. All right, my friends. Shall we? Shall we call it? The time is 10:09. Going to have to call it. Tune in next week, next Wednesday at 9 p.m. for more of whatever this is. More of it. More stories from when I was young. More whatever else it is that I do. That I do. Who knows? I try to come up with things. Oh, I completely forgot to play The Walk. Should I play that? Short. We're tired and late. All right, we'll play The Walk, and then it's pretty short, I think. I knew there was something. That's why I was stalling. I thought, what am I forgetting about? I kept thinking then about Dave Brubeck and then bananas and bunnies. That's all I could get to. So, yes, here's a little walk. That's all I'll say about it. I would say the worst sort of winter day is this sort of winter day. When it snows, oh, it's the wintry mix day. I don't know who invented that, the wintry mix. Like mixed grill. I've never had mixed grill, I've read about it. I don't even know what it is, but not specifically. It seems like bits of sausage and chicken and lobster. Every kind of meat. And all the creatures mixed together on a grill. I don't know what it is about meat, but I don't have the desire that it mix together. Chicken, fine. Sausage, fine. Steak. I'm not a great meat eater. There are periods of time when I don't eat meat at all. But throwing it all together. So this wintry mix of rainy, sleety, slushy. This business where the predominant precipitation is rain. But also in amongst the rain, there are snowflakes, perfect midwinter snowflakes. And there's slush. It's horrendous. Mixed grill. There's pork and chicken, turkeys and horses and cows and venison, all floating down from the sky. Now let me ask you this. Do you ever have a story that you want to tell that you perceive has the great potential to be boring and yet there is something inside you that feels compelled to tell it? So I have a sense about this story. It's not a story, it's just what happened. And I really believe, and perhaps it's because it involves batteries. This is a story about batteries. I don't know if batteries can be made interesting. There are certain things that you include them in a story and they render the story unstoryific. Batteries, milk cartons, rebar, mixed grill. Certain things bring you right out of the world of story. So you won't read a great novel that has a heavy amount of battery information, if any. I would almost say that batteries are never mentioned in great novels. Or rebar. Or milk cartons.
Safety and the safety of others, the following story about batteries has been supercharged and sped up to a rate that renders it much less boring than it might otherwise be.
So here is the boring, potentially boring story. Using the critical error, critical narrative error of a story of a battery. So last week I went up with my recorder, and the battery's getting loaded up, and next to the batteries. And I went way out of the woods, because I had the idea that I would record at a certain location. And something like that, when I woke up at the time. That's the end of that story. It did turn out about what I thought, though.
Dear sir, I write this note to you to tell you of my plight. For at the time of writing it, I'm not a pretty sight. My body is all black and blue, my face a deathly grey. And I write this note to say why I am not at work today. While working on the 14th floor, some bricks I had to clear. But tossing them down from such a height was not a good idea. The foreman wasn't very pleased, he is an awkward sod. And he said I had to cart them down the ladders in me hod. Well, clearing all these bricks by hand, it was so very slow. So I hoisted up a barrel and secured a rope below. But in me haste to do the job, I was too blind to see that a barrel full of building bricks was heavier than me. And so when I untied the rope, the barrel fell like lead. And clinging tightly to the rope, I started up instead. I shot up like a rocket, and to my dismay I found that halfway up I met the bloody barrel coming down. Well, the barrel broke me shoulder as to the ground it sped. And when I reached the top, I banged the pulley with me head. But I clung on tightly, numb with shock from this almighty blow, while the barrel spilled out half its bricks some 14 floors below. Now when these bricks had fallen from the barrel to the floor, I then outweighed the barrel and so started down once more. But I clung on tightly to the rope, me body racked with pain, and halfway down I met the bloody barrel once again. The force of this collision halfway down the office block caused multiple abrasions and a nasty case of shock. But I clung on tightly to the rope as I fell towards the ground, and I landed on the broken bricks the barrel had scattered round. Well, as I lay there on the floor, I thought I'd passed the worst. But the barrel hit the pulley wheel, and then the bottom burst. A shower of bricks rained down on me, I didn't have a hope. As I lay there bleeding on the ground, I let go the bloody rope. The barrel now being heavier, it started down once more. It landed right across me as I lay there on the floor. It broke three ribs in my left arm, and I can only say, I hope you'll understand why I am not at work today.
The chorus. That's one of those cumulative songs, I think they call them. And very beautiful. That there aren't enough of those songs out there. They're almost not songs. They stand alone as odd cultural forms because it's a bit like there's a doggerel element to them. They're not artistic works, but there's some immense amount of joy in that song. If you listen to that song a few times, or the first time, you'll feel it. Something very beautiful about this tiny, fantastical disaster of bricks and guile going up and down and hitting them. Why is that so beautiful? I don't know. There aren't that many songs like that. Not enough. Not enough of the old cumulative story songs. This happened, that happened. There's a children's song quality to it, too. All right, so that's... And the battery, I didn't... Of course, you couldn't hear the boring battery story. It is quite boring. It's a story about going off into the woods. Here's what happens. I'll try to make it quick. Still be boring. It'll just be shorter. But coherent. Or hearable, at least. So I go out. I turn the recorder on in this faraway location, planning to do a bit of walk. Walking and recording. And I get there and the recorder batteries are gone. They're dead. And luckily I've brought some batteries. I reach into my pocket, they're not there. I've lost them. Because I'm always pulling things out of my pocket, and shoving things in gloves, and then yanking out whatever. So I'm losing things. So, a few days go by, and I think, I should do the recording, I'll go out. So I go out again, and this time I've completely forgotten the batteries are dead. Only when I go to turn it on and nothing happens. And I think, this attempt is cursed. It's not going to work, I'll just forget about it. And I look down on the ground and there are the batteries that I had lost a few days earlier. Right where I'm standing ready to record. I pick them up and they're wet and cold and slushy and put them in and then recorded that prior bit. And that's how it works. Often that's how it works. There's a bit of half calamity, half it works out. And they just go side by side. It's good to see it, though. It's good to see it in action. It's good to see it falling apart and then righting itself. That's how it often... Usually it's a different span of time or a different set of circumstances. You don't quite see how the thing that fell over eventually became something that helped you out. Somehow it worked out that you didn't quite get that job. It's hard to remember or see it, unless it's something small and happens quick in a tight time frame, like losing batteries and then finding them again. I keep thinking about bananas. I don't want to. I don't want to think about bananas or batteries. Now they're both... Or bunnies. They're all stuck in my head. Bananas, batteries and bunnies all together. That's the sign, my friends. One final look-see. Check-see. The song is... by the Corys. It's called the Bricklayer's Song, I believe. It also is sometimes called the Letter. It has, as those types of songs often do, it has various forms, different lyrics. People took a particular song and they'll turn it into something slightly different. Dear sir, I write this note to tell you of my plight around the town. I'm not that good at that one. All right, my friends. Thank you so much for joining me. Talk to you next Wednesday. but it is tired, and I am late. Always merry and bright to you. It's tired, and I'm late. The old frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleepless light, come dreams that we're sleeping right. But now it's time to sweep.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep.